No. It has continued up until today, and after around 4 decades, we have a massive, fully equipped defense and military center and the largest counterterrorism organization in the world.
From the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
The Netherlands and Denmark are the only EU nations so far to have supplied F-16 warplanes to fight the Russian army. Ukraine Foreign Minister Dmytro Kuleba told his EU counterparts on Thursday that more countries need to follow suit. He also claims sanctions against Moscow are being circumvented and need to be tightened up.
We should deprive Russia of the capacity to produce missiles and drones. We see that the production is increasing and they use Western elements, Western spare parts in it.
Experts say EU sanctions against foreign nations are set to become even less effective as groupings like BRICS expand further.
They see it as a momentum to say, okay, this is payback time. We are going to show the world that we are capable to build a strong, unified bloc together with Saudi Arabia, Iran, United Arab Emirates. This bloc, if it is well managed and well elaborated on, has a huge potential.
EU defense ministers have been told to ramp up their training of Ukrainian soldiers.
I still think that we have to do more and faster. And I propose the ministers to raise the objective of the mission to 40,000 Ukrainian soldiers trained by the end of the year.
Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban insists Ukraine cannot defeat Russia. As an EU member, Hungary says it will block a proposed 20 billion euro financial package for Ukraine. Orban wants peace talks. Many others do too, as the EU is faced with a growing social crisis. Anti-war campaigners say it is disgraceful that the EU is now in an arms race with NATO, claiming the bloc has moved from being a peace project to a full-scale military operation. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
On the anniversary of the disappearance of Imam Musa Sadr, Lebanese Parliament Speaker Nabi Hibiri reminded the nation of Sadr's legacy, stressing that the only way out of any crisis is unity among Lebanese people. Hibiri called on all parliamentary blocs to participate in a 7-day dialogue in Parliament, after which there would be open-ended sessions to elect a president.
Dear Lebanese, exactly 1 year has passed since my call on the parliamentary blocs on the need to realize a national agreement by electing a president who unites and does not divide, a president who is supported by the Christians, but also by Muslims, and who is before all this a nationalist. Such an accomplishment could assist Lebanon in exiting its economic crisis.
45 years after his disappearance, Imam Sadr is still seen as the main founder founder of resistance against the Israeli occupation, while also representing unity among the Lebanese people.
The legacy of Imam Musa Sadr did not only not die, but it overgrows all the periods of Lebanon. And every time we have a crisis, we remember that only his teachings and what he was calling for can represent the salvation for this country.
This is a very sad day for us. Had Imam Sadr been alive today, we would not have had all these problems we are seeing today. We would not have had these political, economic, or social problems. But we promised him that we will continue his path.
Imam Sadr founded the Lebanese Amal Hope movement in 1974 and openly worked for the rights of the oppressed and the lower class in Lebanon.
Musa Sadr, the Lebanese Imam, represents all what does Lebanon represent. The unity, the ableness of living together, Muslims and Christians, the willingness not to surrender in front of evil. That's what Musa Sadr represents. They intended by kidnapping him to erase all his existence. His existence continued.
It's an opportunity for the Lebanese to remember what the Imam Sadr stands for as far as unity and peace and one country united for its own people.
The prominent Shiite cleric disappeared on August 31, 1978, during an official visit to the Libyan capital, Tripoli. Lebanon still holds former Libyan dictator Muammar Gaddafi responsible for his disappearance, along with two of his companions, while blaming the Libyan authorities for concealing details which could uncover the fate of Sadr.
45 years on, and the case of Musa Sadr's disappearance remains unclosed. The people of Lebanon unanimously believe that this is not a lost cause, for his legacy and the values of resistance and justice which he fought for have not died down. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Over 600 Sunni clerics, scholars, and thinkers from different parts of Iran took part in a meeting with Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi to share their thoughts on the issues facing the Muslim world. The meeting was held on the occasion of the Government Week in Iran. Addressing the meeting, Iran's president said a united Muslim society is the biggest obstacle to global arrogance.
An organized, coherent, and united society moves towards a clear and purposeful destination. Having goals and being dynamic are the main characteristics of a nation. A united society and Islamic Ummah is the biggest obstacle to the global arrogance and the system of domination. And this is the biggest obstacle to the dominators. After World War II, when two power blocks were formed in the world, and after the collapse of the Soviet Union, the hegemonic powers considered the unity of Muslims as the only obstacle to their dominance. Therefore, they always try to take measures against the Islamic world, but unity is the best solution to counter such measures.
Sunni and Shia religious scholars and elites believe that global arrogance is seeking to sow discord among Muslims by creating obstacles, launching propaganda campaign, and forming tech theory groups. But the Islamic Ummah should be vigilant to foil all the plots.
Such a meeting provides a good opportunity to offer better practical solutions for forging further unity and convergence between Shia and Sunni. The government of the Islamic Republic does not believe in any separation between Sunni and Shia Muslims. Dr. Raisi believes that both Shia and Sunni Muslims are of one essence. Accordingly, good achievements have been made in the economic, political, and social status of Sunni Muslims in the country.
Regarding the existing commonalities among different sects of Islamic schools of thought, such a gathering would send out this message to the enemy that Muslims are united and they cannot easily create discord among Shia and Sunni Muslims.
If all Muslims get united and join hands, no enemy would dare to sow the seeds of discord among them. The enemies do not want Muslims to make progress, but if we are united and support each other, the enemies cannot do anything.
The participating Iranian Shia and Sunni elites and scholars unanimously believed that what they all have in common is to think about the country's national interests and problems, which can certainly discourage the enemies.
Iranian officials and the scholars attending this event believe that creating unity among Sunni and Shia Muslims is indeed a strategy for the Islamic Republic of Iran to help foil the plots hatched by the enemies of the Islamic world. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
The United States is on a record annual pace for mass shootings, averaging two such incidents every day this year. High summer temperatures, soaring economic inequality, a nation awash in guns and with lax supervision over them, there seems to be a universal belief that the epidemic of mass shootings won't decline anytime soon. But there is increasing anger over which mass shootings get political attention and which do not. Every day, 120 Americans are killed with guns and more than 200 are shot and wounded. But the recent murder of three black people in Florida by a white racist was immediately seized upon by the political classes, even though domestic far-right extremists killed just 25 people last year.
As I made clear in my inaugural address, white supremacy is a poison. It's a poison. It's been allowed to grow faster and fester in our communities to the point where the intelligence community is determined, the U.S. intelligence community is determined that domestic terrorism rooted in white supremacy is the greatest terrorist threat we face in the homeland.
Shootings at schools also get massive attention, but what goes repeatedly ignored are the victims at the most common site of debilitating gun violence, poor neighborhoods.
It's a tragedy when these things are happening, but when those things happen, they usually happen in these white schools, in these rich neighborhoods. They're getting funding, they're getting support, the media is talking about it, the world cares about gun safety. But we're talking about it on a daily basis and no one cares. I had a 13-year-old say, I carry a gun to school because I want to make it there safely, not because I want to hurt somebody. I think that speaks volume for a 13-year-old to be able to say something like that. And I think those are the situations, the stories that need to be told, and those are the ones that need to be invested in, and how are we able to make that shift and make that happen.
Gun control is a constant media topic, but there is almost no discussion about the economic and social redistribution programs which have been proven to reduce mass shootings in poor areas.
The investment is not going in the right spaces. They invest so much, so heavily on the policing aspect of it, and they've done that for decades, and it's repeatedly proven to not work or make a difference. Building community together, giving God opportunity they've never seen, taking them off the block, taking them to other spaces, and investing that money and putting money in their pockets and teaching them skills at the same time. And that's the aspect and component that's missing.
The U.S. gun homicide rate is 26 times that of other high-income countries. Their economic inequality is the highest of any nation in the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, the so-called Club of Rich Countries. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
Almost 3 years after he was given the all clear by pharmacy regulator, the General Pharmaceutical Council, pro-Palestine activist Nazim Ali's fitness to pursue his career as a pharmacist is being questioned again by the same regulator.
A tribunal at the regulator's headquarters here in Canary Wharf, East London, has been tasked with establishing whether or not Mr. Ali's words, such as Zionists are not Jews, which he spoke at a 2017 Al-Quds rally in the British capital, were, quote, objectively anti-Semitic.
The hearing was pushed for by what's collectively known as the Zionist lobby in the UK, pro-Israeli organizations with a penchant for going after pro-Palestine activists.
It's a deliberate sort of attempt at conflating and making the water muddy, as you will, that distinction between anti-Semitism and sort of anti-Zionism or anti-Israel speech. And they're deliberately sort of muddying the water. They're using the IHRA definition, and they're sort of throwing as much as they can to confuse things. And it's a way of sort of silencing speech.
Nazim Ali, a pharmacist of some 30 years, is but one example of how the Zionist lobby weaponizes anti-Semitism to silence critics of Israel. Other recent examples are former Labour Party leader Jeremy Corbyn, former Labour MP Chris Williamson, the rapper Low Key, and Bristol University professor David Miller. Also present at the hearing, Mr. Ali's family, who have experienced his ordeal with him every step of the way for the past 6 years.
Well, it most certainly hasn't been easy when you see your father plastered over different news outlets online and in print media with headlines and photos that aren't the most flattering, that represent him in a very negative light. I can't go on the record and say that people are lying, per se, but certainly there are many falsities that are out there that have been published against him that cause a lot of frustration. And one day we hope that justice will be served, not only in the courts, but also in the public eye as well.
Just a song? No, you mentioned the word bomb.
Also known for his sharp wit and his stand-up comedy that challenges Muslim stereotypes and anti-Muslim tropes, Mr. Ali took to social media before the hearing, asking his supporters to pray for him to succeed in putting the case against him to rest once and for all. Saeed Pourreza, London.
A global campaign has been launched by humanitarian activists calling for a lifting of the blockade on Sana'a International Airport. The airport was forcibly closed by the Saudi-led coalition shortly after its invasion on Yemen in 2015. The signing of a ceasefire agreement deal with the Saudi-led coalition last year was supposed to alleviate the suffering of the Yemeni patients. But in effect, nothing has changed for those in need of medical treatment.
According to reports, nearly 8,000 sick Yemenis have passed away during the ceasefire because they were not able to fly out of the country in time to get proper medical treatment. Medical health officials are calling the closure of Sana'a Airport a grave public health tragedy.
And that's because more sick Yemenis will continue to die if they are unable to fly out for life-saving medical treatment.
We launched this campaign with both Yemeni and non-Yemeni activists to make it clear that Sana'a Airport remains besieged. Only three flights consisting of 700 passengers are allowed a week. Before the aggression, that number was 6,000 passengers a week. There are many sick patients who need to fly out of the country for immediate medical treatment. Currently, there are 30,000 sick patients unable to fly out of the country because of this blockade.
The campaign to open Sana'a Airport has attracted much support from human rights and anti-war activists worldwide, demanding an end to the blockade.
From Canada, we join our voice to people in Yemen and all over the world that are condemning and denouncing the continued U.S.-Saudi Emirati aggression and blockade against the people of Yemen. The U.S.-backed, Saudi-led bombing campaign and war on Yemen for over 8 years have destroyed hospitals, healthcare infrastructure. Thousands today in Yemen cannot access medical care. Thousands are waiting to be able to travel outside of Yemen to access that medical care.
Today, Yemen needs to rebuild. Yemen needs access to health care. For that, this blockade needs to be lifted immediately. The land, air, and sea blockade needs to be lifted so that the people of Yemen can have access to medical supplies and supplies needed to rebuild their country.
According to reports, an estimated 120,000 Yemenis have died as a direct result of the closure of Sana'a Airport. Many of those patients are dialysis patients who were not able to get the kidney transplants available only abroad. Yusuf Maudi, Sana'a.
Boasting the highlights of his presidency, in the third press conference held during his tenure, President Ebrahim Raisi put the spotlight on successful efforts made over the past 2 years to expand foreign relations, pointing out that enemies have failed to isolate Iran and drive the nation into despair. The Iranian president stressed that Tehran has managed to forge strong relations with Islamic and like-minded countries.
We've expanded our foreign ties and improved the level of political and economic relations. Our commercial ties have grown 14% compared to the previous government. These achievements have been made while the enemy has tried to follow two strategies of isolating Iran in the world and disappointing the people inside the country, which it failed in both.
President Raisi's administration has been following numerous agendas in Iran foreign policy, the most important of which is the JCPOA and the removal of sanctions. But at the same time, Tehran has also been able to gain a foothold in the political equations in the region and beyond by obtaining memberships in the Shanghai Cooperation Organization and BRICS.
Alliances like the Shanghai Cooperation Organization and BRICS are definitely effective against U.S. unilateralism. Our membership in these organizations shows that the enemy did not succeed in his policy to isolate Iran, and our political, commercial, and economic situation shows that the enemy has failed in this strategy.
But the highlight of the administration's efforts is the stronger relations it has forged with regional countries and the resumption of ties with Saudi Arabia in particular.
Iran has made great achievements as far as foreign policy is concerned, and according to the president, it will be taking more steps to expand its foreign relations. Gisum Shahmadi, Tehran.
In the limelight.
Britain is facing a homelessness crisis, with a number of people living in temporary accommodation in England at a 25-year high. The homelessness crisis in the United Kingdom comes on the heels of a mortgage crisis, which has been brewing for some time. We take a look at some of the world media and press's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Independent has covered this story and tells us more. Figures show the record number of British families are being forced to live in temporary accommodation, with experts blaming a shameful lack of social housing. A special investigation by The Independent has revealed that a majority of local authorities had failed to build a single council house last year, as waiting lists continued to soar. Now, official figures show almost 105,000 households were in temporary accommodation at the end of March of this year, a 25-year high. This included more than 131,000 children, the highest level since records for that measure began in 2004. Campaigners slammed the government for failing to support the building of affordable homes and warned the time for empty words on building social homes had long passed. Matt Downey, chief executive of Crisis, said families were trapped in temporary accommodation due to the crippling cost of years of no investment in housing benefit and a shameful lack of social house building. Matt Downey added, "Not only do people not have the stability and security of a home, but they're often left to cope in just one room, with no facilities to cook meals or do washing," noting that households across the country desperately need more social homes. Paula Barker, the shadow homelessness minister, said the figures were a shameful indictment of the British government's record, which have devastating consequences for thousands of families and children. Of the 104,510 households in temporary accommodation by the end of March, a high since records began in 1998, 64,940 were households with children. Both of these figures are up by about 10% on the same period last year. Temporary accommodation is offered to homeless households who are waiting for their application for help to be processed and to be offered a settled home. The latest statistics come just a day after Britain's Minister for Levelling Up, Housing and Communities and Minister for Intergovernmental Relations, Michael Gove, claimed the government would slash red tape to address the housing crisis and allow shops, takeaways and betting shops to be turned into living spaces. The housing minister also pledged to spark intensive building in cities and change planning laws to allow more home extensions. Michael Gove's announcements were mocked in the House of Lords by Labour's Baroness Taylor, who stated, "With over 1 million people on social housing waiting lists and 7,000 social rented homes built last year, does the minister really think a few flats built over chip shops is going to solve the problem?" There is a huge need for affordable housing, and local authorities, who were traditionally big builders of social housing, have decreased the number of homes they built in recent decades. Analysis of government data by The Independent found that in each of the last five financial years, 2/3 of councils failed to build a single home themselves. In 2021-2022, 207 out of 307 councils that provided data to the government had not built a home in that period. A snap survey of district and borough councils in England carried out by The Independent also found that just over half of local authorities did not build a single home in the whole of 2022. As the latest figures were released, Polly Neat, chief executive at homeless charity Shelter, said, "The time for empty words on building social homes and overdue promises on ending no-fault evictions has long passed." Polly Neat added, "To end homelessness for good, we need genuinely affordable homes." Michael Gove agrees social homes are essential to solving the housing emergency, so it's time for his government to get on and build them. Riverside, an organisation which describes itself as the largest provider of accommodation for people affected by homelessness, described the figures as very worrying. The figures released by the Department for Levelling Up Housing and Communities also show nearly 80,000 households face homelessness in England between January and March of this year, the highest figure since 2018. The charity Shelter said a major contributing factor to rising homelessness was the instability of private renting, with the loss of a tenancy now the leading cause. The British newspaper The Guardian has also reported on the same story. In the last year, 24,060 UK households were threatened with homelessness as a result of a Section 21 no-fault eviction, which allows landlords to repossess their properties without having to establish fault on the part of the tenant. This is up 21% compared to the previous 12 months. Meanwhile, rent prices hit a new record in the past weeks, with property website Rightmove recording that the average rent outside London had risen to £1,231 per month. The Salvation Army warned that unless the freeze on housing benefit is lifted, more families would lose their homes because of rent rises. Nick Redmore, the charity's director of homelessness services, said, "Today's figures show more people than ever are losing the battle to keep a roof over their heads. Unless housing benefits are urgently raised to cover the cost of rent, the homelessness crisis will only worsen." Between January and March of this year, 1,760 households were made homeless due to rent arrears, compared with 1,390 in the same period a year earlier. Households needing help from local authorities because they were homeless or threatened with homelessness by March this year rose 5.7% on the same period last year to 83,240. Of the 41,950 households assessed as homeless and therefore owed a relief duty help to secure settled accommodation by their local authority between January and March of this year, 11,250 were households with children, up 12.1% from the same quarter last year. Of the households in temporary accommodation in the first quarter of this year, 13,780 were living in bed and breakfasts, This is up by more than a third, or 37%, from the same time last year. The number of households who were sleeping rough when they approached their local authority for help was up by almost a fifth, or 18%, from the first quarter of last year to 3,770 households. The homelessness crisis in England comes on the heels of a mortgage crisis which has been brewing for some time. The Bank of England hiked interest rates by 50 basis points to 5% back in June. The move has affected millions of homeowners in Britain, as the interest rates on many mortgages are directly linked to the central bank's base rate. Tenants have seen their rent increase as buy-to-let landlords pass on higher mortgage repayments. Estimates suggest that the Bank of England interest rate hike would see 1.2 million British households run out of savings by the end of the year due to higher mortgage payments. Higher borrowing costs are not just affecting households with mortgages and other loans, but forcing companies to tread more carefully in their management of costs in a tougher economy. The mortgage crisis comes against the backdrop of slowdown in Britain's economy.
Option for today and a better tomorrow. IRIB English Radio. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome to Spotlight. Visiting Lebanon, Iran's foreign minister, Hossein Amir Abdollahian, says that Tehran is ready to help Lebanon end its energy crisis. Tehran has also offered to assist Syria in reconstruction of the country. This is despite numerous sanctions imposed on Iran by U.S.-led Western countries that claim these bans are because of Iran's destabilizing actions. But what are these destabilizing actions? Is it Iran's contribution to the defeat of Daesh terror group in the region? Is it Iran's support for oppressed peoples of the region? Or is it Iran's fight against spread of narcotics in the region? Or is it Iran's efforts to root out foreign interference in regional issues? Let's see what our guests have to say about that. Joining us on tonight's Spotlight, we have historian and journalist Breck Jonkers joining us from Hasselt, Belgium. And joining us from Houston, Texas, we have human rights activist Mohsen Naft.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Yonkers from Hazelt. Sir, the U.S. and co. accuse Iran of destabilizing actions in the region. This is while Tehran has expressed readiness to help Lebanon end its energy crisis, has assisted in reconstruction efforts in Syria, and has been calling for countries in the region to be more unified in providing security for the region. Are these destabilizing actions, in your opinion, or just actions that Washington and its allies are not happy with?
Well, they are surely actions that destabilize the plans that exist in the halls of Washington, D.C., Tel Aviv, London, and Paris, and other places in which the Western imperialist powers are, of course, plotting from and where they make their plans for what they want to do to the Middle East. This has been going on since, at the very least, the beginning of the 21st century, and especially after the 9/11 attacks, in which the Americans were really putting their plans into motion to create what they called the Greater Middle East Project in order to take over control of the entire area. So when the Iranian Islamic Republic has helped significantly in destroy the Daesh terrorists, when Iran has stood by the Syrian Arab Republic, stood by Lebanon, stood by the Palestinian cause, and stood in general by the entire Islamic region and the Islamic world, and particularly that in West Asia, which is a crucially important strategic region for U.S. And Zionist imperialist designs. This, of course, is for United States perspective, from an American imperialist perspective, this destabilizes the plans that they already had. So that is basically what it comes down to. It's all a matter of perspective in this case. The United States claims that Iran is a destabilizing factor, while Iran has never really attacked the country since the Islamic Revolution. Iran has never overthrown a government in its entire history, and they are not planning, as far as anything points out, to ever do so. Whereas the United States, of course, has overthrown governments in Iraq, in Afghanistan, and in Libya, and have tried to do the same thing in Syria. And they have bumped into significant resistance from the local population, from the Iraqis, from the Syrians, but also from allies in the region, considering, in this case, most particularly the Islamic Republic of Iran. And that's the major reason, I think, why they have such a hatred of Iran at this moment.
Mohsen Naqvi, the U.S. constantly demonizes Iran's quote-unquote regional activities. Iran has responded in the past, saying that the U.S. has sealed the highest number of arms sales deals, signed many military and defense cooperation agreements in the region, and its plentiful military bases jeopardize regional peace and stability. By the looks of it, the U.S. could be the real destabilizing factor in the region. How can an extra-regional player like the U.S. make such accusations about Iran and about inter-regional stability?
Well, the U.S. Doesn't really stand or have any kind of a moral leeway to comment on the actions of the Islamic Republic. It's a matter of fact that as soon as Iran intervened into Syria, we now see peace in Syria. We don't see Daesh in Syria anymore. As soon as Iran enters the field in Iraq, we see the extermination of Daesh there. With Iran's diplomacy today and Iran's ties with Saudi Arabia, we see peace in Yemen now. It is because of Iran's actions that Iraq now hosts one of the largest pilgrimages in the world. The Arbaeen Walk, the Arbaeen Procession is hosted by Iraq because of the efforts that the Islamic Republic has made in this region. It is because of the intervention of Iran, and it is because of the diplomatic efforts of Iran that we somewhat see a somewhat stable government in Afghanistan. And on the contrary, it is the mess, the atrocities, the oppression of the U.S. government, of the U.S., of U.S. diplomacy, of U.S. foreign policy that Iran has corrected, not by the means of weapons, but by the means of self-defense and by the means of diplomacy. And unfortunately, it is these actions that has affected the so-called plan of the U.S. empire to provide security to the Zionist regime, failing. We see that every single plan that the U.S. government had outside of its borders in terms of its influence and in terms of its domination in West Asia, it is the Islamic Republic that has been sanctioned since the revolution by the Western Empire. It has been sanctioned, and yet it managed to defeat the policies, the atrocious policies of the U.S. empire in this region. This is a matter of fact that everyone sees with their own eyes. No matter what concocted statistics that the Western Empire presents before the world, it is a mere lie. So, if anything, the Islamic Republic has been a source of peace in this region, and it has been an actor that has empowered its allies and doesn't dominate its allies, unlike the U.S. Empire.
Sure. Brecht Yonkers, one of the most evident contributions Iran made to stability in the region was the battle against Daesh, and how Iran, with its anti-terror icon, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, battled Daesh in Iraq to neutralize the Takfiri terrorists. Talk to us about the pivotal role Iran played during the battle against Daesh.
I think this can never be overstated, how important the Iranian efforts were in rooting out Daesh. Of course, we can never forget about the efforts by the Iraqis and the Syrians themselves, as well as the support by countries such as Russia to this battle. But Iran has played an absolutely pivotal role, and most importantly, Shahid Qasem Soleimani, of course, in this struggle. In fact, we know now from intelligence reports and from eventually from reports that have been revealed that even things such as the Russian intervention, the Russian support, increased Russian support to the Syrian Arab Republic for a significant part was the doing of Shahid Soleimani himself as well, who was in contact with various foreign partners in order to try to support the Syrian Arab Republic and the Republic of Iraq against the scourge of Daesh, Takfiri, Wahhabism. So it is something that it is almost unimaginable now, seeing the relative stability of countries such as Syria and Iraq in a certain way as well. It is even unimaginable now to think about the fact that just years ago, less than a decade ago, there was an actual period in which the complete and total collapse of both Syria and Iraq and the existence of these two countries as countries in and of themselves was at risk. There was a very great and grave chance that Syria and Iraq would basically cease existing. Their border was already completely obliterated by the fact that Daesh controlled both sides of it in, as part of their falsely declared so-called caliphate. And these Daesh terrorists, they controlled both Syrian and Iraqi land, as well as a significant chunk of their population, which they kept as de facto slaves, as well as, of course, the natural resources that abound in both countries. So when you see all these things happening less than 10 years ago, the rollback and the destruction of this Wahhabi scourge is almost, you can basically call it nothing short of a miracle. And the significant pillar of this miracle was, of course, worked by the forces of the Islamic Republic of Iran, most importantly, the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps and the Al-Quds Force, and just in general, the massive amount of support that was given to Syria and to Iraq in particular in order to destroy this. This is one of the major events of the 21st century so far, one of the major events maybe of the past half century or longer in the West Asian region, is the defeat of Daesh. And with the defeat of Daesh comes the defeat of the latest plot that was concocted in the halls of Washington and Tel Aviv, because after it turns out that they could not just overthrow governments and place pawns and puppets in charge, which was the original plan around 2001, the American Zionist Empire decided to basically use a new strategy. And that strategy was a strategy of chaos, the total and utter destruction of the region. And Iran is the country that stopped this.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Mohsen Arvi, let's turn our attention to Iran's role in the resistance front and its support for Palestine. Just recently, Iran's foreign minister, Hossein Amir Abdullahian, who's in Lebanon, reiterated Tehran's support for the Palestinian cause, saying Palestine's liberation is the central plank of Tehran's foreign policy in the region. Now, for the U.S.-Israeli alliance, that has to be considered destabilizing, as Iran has been firm opposition to Washington and Tel Aviv's machinations and plots for the region.
Absolutely, there's no doubt about that. I think Iran has proven itself to be a player in world politics and in regional politics where their strategies and their plans have been effective. In terms of supporting the resistance, I think the one source of resistance against the policies of the Americans has been the formation of the Axis of Resistance, the resistance front, the true resistance front, in which we see Hezbollah as a key player in defeating the so-called Zionist regime. And it was after the defeat in 2006 when Sayyid Nasrallah deemed the Zionist regime as the spider's web, that Israel is as weak as the spider's web. This understanding that the world had that Israel is undefeated, that this small number, a small military power like the Zionist regime could rule over the entire region. First in 2000 and then in 2006, Hezbollah managed to absolutely obliterate any such perception that the world had. That was that first and second victory. And then we see that this sense of resistance that Hezbollah started off with, and that was also seen before Hezbollah, it was also seen by the Sipahi Pasdaran against another American puppet, Saddam Hussein, who was funded, placed, and financed by the U.S. government. Saddam Hussein was also defeated in the famous war, which is called the Defa'i Muqaddasa, in which the Islamic Republic defeated Saddam Hussein in war. We see the resistance then expanding over to supporting Hamas.
Okay, let's cross over to Mr. Yonkers once again. Mr. Narvi, we're experiencing some technical difficulties there, but while we figure that out, I want to address a question to Mr. Yonkers. President Raisi's foreign policy has been based on cooperation with all countries, with an emphasis on a look to the east. We know that Iran will be joining BRICS officially at the start of next year. Iran was recently ratified as a member of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. Is it safe to say that the maximum pressure campaign enacted by the U.S. and attempts by Washington and its allies in isolating Iran has not worked?
I think it's definitely a correct assessment to say that. And in fact, this has actually happened several times before in with several countries that the United States tried to put maximum pressure on. It's a strategy that they have started honing back in the, at least as far back as the beginning of the Cold War. And very often it has sometimes it has worked, but very often it has led to increased resentment of the United States and the country that they are sanctioning and that they are targeting and trying to punish. And has in fact then led to that said country moving further and further away from any possibility of being influenced by the United States. And we have seen this as well with the Islamic Republic of Iran. I don't need to tell you that there have definitely been times and periods in which Iran was very much open to negotiation, and even now they always keep the door at a certain point still open for further talks with the United States. But the United States, both the Democrats and the Republicans, they are constantly trying to outbid and outdo each other in hawkish attitude and an attitude of trying to destroy the Islamic Republic of Iran. And one thing in which they have severely miscalculated is that, especially since last year, especially since the beginning of the of 2022, we are speaking now of a world that is truly becoming multipolar, and no longer the unipolar U.S.-dominated world that existed at least since 1991 at the end of the Cold War. We are now existing in a world in which several countries, even when they don't agree with each other politically, they are willing to come together and negotiate in order for their own mutual benefit, and no longer take dictates on commands just from whatever imperialist power tries to dictate them. In many cases, that is either the United States or the United Kingdom. So that's why Iran has now grasped an opportunity to really use this new multipolar system in order to, for example, carry good relations with and membership with the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, and that's particularly important on a military point of view, which means good relations with China, good relations with Russia, and with a certain extent at the same time with India and Pakistan, within this alliance of sorts, which comes as part of this rise of a Eurasian integration and a Eurasian connection, in which these countries, including Iran, of course, they retain their full sovereignty and their full independence and their full permission to basically conduct their own affairs in any way they see fit within their own borders, but respect each other as potential allies and as partners. And this is something that severely has weakened the grasp and stranglehold of the West on the West Asian region.
And back to Mr. Mohsen Naqvi in Houston, Texas. Just recently, Iran's foreign minister said the normalization of ties between Tehran and Riyadh is a positive step and will have positive impact in the region. Now, with Saudi Arabia also adding its name to the list of BRICS countries, and of course the recent Chinese-mediated revival of relations with Iran, are countries in the West Asia region slowly moving away from U.S. influence?
Absolutely. There's no doubt that the West Asian countries are moving away from the influence of the U.S. empire, and it is high time that they realize that this is the move forward. When we analyze and see the U.S. alliance means U.S. slavery, means you lose your sovereignty when you ally with the U.S. empire, and we have several examples. One of those main examples is Saudi Arabia itself, and Iran has always had a policy to be in good relations with its neighbors. There is absolutely no doubt about that. And Iran has proven that its relations with Saudi Arabia and that the Islamic Republic, when it initiated the normalization of ties with Saudi Arabia, they proved that when they said that they want good relations with all their neighbors, they weren't bluffing. It's as a matter